Hi, everybody. This is Marlene with Miami Ghost Chronicles, and I am inside room 226 of the very haunted Clouston Inn. As you can tell, it's a renovated room, and I'm on the second floor. It overlooks the side of the hotel, and it's not one of the supposedly haunted rooms. It's renovated very nicely, so I'm gonna let my videographer Henry, was passed out on the bed, do his job. Midnight. Hold on.
We had just been out by Lake Okeechobee, because previous to midnight, it was the 89th year anniversary of the 1928 hurricane that swept through Lake Okeechobee, especially in this area of Clouston, which is the southern end of Lake Okeechobee. I released a video a couple of weeks ago where it detailed the events, and about 3,000 lives were lost or so. They think it might have been more, since many bodies were never recovered. They were swept out into the Everglades. There was also about 12,000 people hurt, 35,000 people displaced, homeless, which by those standards, this was 1928, that was quite a high amount of people, because at that time, this was not that populated. And as a matter of fact, we just went through Hurricane Irma down in South Florida, and we just recovered our electricity, so it brings that story very much into perspective when you come from not something that's devastating, but when you look at what the infrastructure and what the ability were of the people back almost 90 years ago. You can imagine the hardships. But anyway, because I was visiting here in Clouston, going to see if I could capture anything on the lake shore, which is supposedly, this anniversary is one of the times that the ghosts are seen in that area, I decided to stop here at the Clouston Inn, which was built around 1925, I believe. It did survive that hurricane of 1928. And, you know, it's passed through different hands, of course, through the years. And it has certain rooms that are haunted. For example, room 255, which I imagine has to be on this floor somewhere, is where Mrs. Conklin lived, and her husband ran the Miami Sea Aquarium, and apparently they lived out of that room, and she supposedly haunts that room. And there's also a room 118 downstairs, which is haunted by an unknown woman that has been seen. People, employees describe also at times where their clothing or their hair is tugged. And looking through some of the description of different people, I think there's more going on here than just those two rooms. Maybe those are, as a matter of fact, the staff here are said to knock before entering the rooms, as in rooms plural, almost as if I want to say warn, but also make sure that they don't see anything they don't want to see. So let's see what happens. I'm in room 226 here on the second floor. As a matter of fact, I'm right at the very end of the hallway. Okay. My room here overlooks the back and the side, and it's about almost 1:30 a.m. So far, nothing. But to be honest with you, before now, I had the TV on and I had noise going on. So let's see if we have any visits from guests that never checked out. Imagine, considering that this hotel, or this inn, has been around for almost 100 years. If it holds true, like most hotels, it's definitely got some type of haunting. Possibly residual, but more than likely there is a chance that you do have some type of intelligent hauntings. And I'm thinking it might not just be restricted to the rooms in and of themselves. Let's see what happens. Never know. Either way, I will immediately start filming if and when we either hear or feel or see, God, if we can see something, I might be sorry I said that, I can tell. So I'll get back with you guys.
Hi, everybody. Well, you just saw us arrive there at
the Clouston Inn. It was like a little bit after midnight, and I know that sometimes that's you know, it's you know, like I said many times, supernatural is not an on-demand thing. So I wasn't really surprised that right after we got there, you know, we just, or at least me, because Henry had just gone off to sleep after a while, you know, actually witnessed anything or felt anything. And to be honest with you, I didn't. You know, when we got to the hotel, it was very quiet. Like I said, it was late. We went to our rooms. It was very nice, very peaceful. I didn't get any eerie feelings or anything. And originally, we were going to do this strictly about the Clouston Inn because it does have a reputation of being haunted. But it's not the first time that when I do research, it just takes on a life of its own. And there were so many interesting and eerie situations and happenings in Clouston and around the Clouston Inn, because it's one of the oldest buildings there, that I wanted to include it in this video. But like I said, whenever you do any type of paranormal investigation, one of the most important things, and I've stressed this in various videos, is to do your research, because the research helps you a lot to understand what was happening, what were the conditions, and maybe sometimes even lead to the identity of some type of haunting that's going on, whether it's residual or whether it's intelligent. It just gives you a better idea of what's going on. So if you're any type of paranormal investigator worth your salt, you're going to take the time to do some type of research. And that's exactly what I did. So let's start at the beginning. Because like I said, when you start at the beginning, you start understanding what was happening, the people, the events. And as you see, I'm going to go through all these different things that went on in Clouston and around the Clouston Inn. And these are just examples, because I have found that this usually is just the tip of the iceberg. And there was so many. Boy, if you think of this is just a sleepy southern town in Sugarland, there's more to it than that. But anyway, it was this area, before it became known as Clouston, of course, it was first inhabited by the Miami's Indian, and then later on the Seminoles. Now, by 1900, the commercial fishermen had established fish camps and named the sandy strip of land Sandpoint. Now, because remember, this Clouston is located on the southern end, towards the southern end of Lake Okeechobee. This is one of the towns that grew up around the industries of that area. But everything started out with Lake Okeechobee. Now, in 1915, surprisingly, Japanese families arrived and started the first farming settlements. As a matter of fact, I believe one of them even developed a certain type of orange that was renowned. And you're going to see in some of the slides, two Japanese from the 1920s posed in their, you know, in what they would normally wear, their Japanese clothing. And I was very surprised to find that. Now, around that time, a northern socialite by the name of Marion O'Brien, she settled in Sandpoint, okay, because this is what it was known as then, Sandpoint. And believe it or not, she was the first mayor of Moorhaven, which is very close to Clouston. And in 1917, she was the first female mayor east of the Mississippi River. Now, in 1921, she, along with her husband and their business associate by the name of Alfonso Cluis, named the town Clouston. And they completed the construction of a railroad line that provided transportation for all the winter crops grown in the area. As a matter of fact, at one point, Marion O'Brien even tried, she wanted to make this area like even to like a Chicago, the equivalent of Chicago in industry. Later on, she wasn't able to for a lot of various reasons that I won't get into. But, you know, she did do a lot by, well, actually naming the town. It became like an actual town. And she brought the construction of the railroad line, which was so necessary to any type of industry. Now, the area went into an economic depression, of course, after the 1926 and 1928 hurricanes. And then the Great Depression of 1929. And as you know, I already did a prior video of the 1928 hurricane, because The Clewston Inn was built in 1925, and almost just in time for those two hurricanes that came. The 1926 killed only about 300 people. The 1928 killed possibly in excess of 3,000. Quite a difference. Now, like I found in a lot of small Florida towns around this time, many of the original fishermen on the lake had fled justice in other areas. Okay, now on the weekends, Okeechobee, Canal Point, and other settlements, including Clewston, were filled with these fishermen, cattlemen, loggers, farmers, field hands, that all they wanted to do was get a drink, and they were ready to fight. As a matter of fact, a sign in the Clewston Inn warned patrons: Saturday nights, dancing from 9 to 11, fights from 11 to 2. All right, so what does that tell you? This was a rough and tumble frontier town, okay? This is the same as any of the ones that you read about out west, where your so-called regular people sometimes are escaping justice in some other part of the country. And they were very hard workers, and a lot of the places where they would go to get that drink and have a fight possibly was the Clewston Inn. And the reason why I'm saying this is, a lot of times people, when they do paranormal investigations and, they get all this communication from entities that they have no clue, this is the source of a lot of intelligent hauntings. Not only the ones that are documented, but can you imagine here this area around the Clewston Inn was filled with all these different people from all these different backgrounds. And I'm sure a lot of them were kind of unsavory. I mean, so many things could have happened out there that nobody ever became aware of, or that these were the people that eventually did come to haunt the Clewston Inn. And in and of itself, a hotel is usually a hotspot for paranormal events. Everybody will tell you that. But think about it. Can you imagine if you're one of these guys or girls, by the way, who was living there and worked hard, and your favorite hangout place on come the weekend was the Clewston Inn, and something happened to you, whether you were killed or you died? It's not a far stretch of the imagination to think that if for some reason you didn't go on into the great beyond, into the light, you would drift back maybe to where you felt happiest, which was the Clewston Inn. All right. And by this, I say sometimes it doesn't necessarily have to be a documented murder or death on a site for you to have a discarnate that is being recorded or being witnessed, and people will scratch their heads saying, "Who's this?" Well, this is the who this is. So anyway, like I said, bootleggers made their own shine in the swamps, or bought whiskey from offshore smugglers and resold it to illegal establishments spawned by prohibition. So you could tell, along this time, when all these hurricanes are, wreaking havoc in the area, you also have bootlegging and, everybody trying to dodge prohibition. And as a matter of fact, you had Black Islanders from the Bahamas, known as Conks, who brought the liquor from the Bahamas to Riviera Beach and vice versa, and then they would smuggle it back and forth. Now, also around this time, the Clewston Inn, it would host hunting parties. All right. Also, people would live there while their houses were being built in the area, which I make mention of it, where it wasn't strictly just a hotel, as most people think of the hotel. A lot of people actually lived here at the Clewston Inn, way back, and from what I could tell, way back in the 1920s, because a lot of people would come down from up north like they do now. And remember, prior to 1929, there was what they call the Florida land boom going on, and which means a lot of people were buying up land, and people would live there until their houses were completed. Now, another thing which I found during those two hurricanes, people actually took shelter inside the inn. Luckily, none of them died. Like I said, none of them died. And afterwards, they also they it was a headquarter for the water supply. there at the Clouston Inn. So a lot of things happened at the Clouston Inn. In 1937, it burned down and it was rebuilt. But you could tell that even right after it was built, I would say within those first few years, it saw so much drama, so many events, so many people. I wouldn't be surprised. Think about it. This is after it was built. Here comes the storm, the 1926 and 1928 storms that killed hundreds and, well, at some point, thousands of people. All these people taking shelter. Don't you think those people were terrorized? They were so scared. You know, and the reason why I say that is that maybe you have somebody that's sensitive come in and might have some type of feelings which like that, and that they can't account for it, and that's the source right there. Now, I came across something which was super interesting. I didn't know about it, which was that over there in that area, in the Everglades, but especially out of that Clouston area, we had our own version of Bonnie and Clyde. And this guy's name was John Ashley, and he was an American outlaw, a bank robber, a bootlegger, of course, and he was an occasional pirate that was active in South Florida during the 1910s and 1920s. Okay, and between 1915 to 1924, that he was called or known as the King of the Everglades or the Swamp Bandit. He operated from various hideouts close to the Clouston area and in the Everglades itself. This was like his favorite hideout that he would go to, which, of course, having been raised in that area, he was very familiar, you know, where to go. Now, his gang robbed nearly $1 million from at least 40 banks, while at the same time hijacking numerous shipments of illegal whiskey being smuggled into the state from the Bahamas. Now, remember, $1 million back in the 1920s was a lot of money. Now, among poor Florida crackers, he was considered a folk hero who represented a symbol of resistance to bankers, lawmen, and wealthy landowners. Now, during this time, he had a 13-year feud with a Palm Beach County sheriff named George Baker, which ended with the death of Ashley and three of his lieutenants, which took place in 1924. Now, this really all started for him when he went to trial for the murder of a Seminole Indian by the name of DeSoto Tiger in 1910. Now, despite overwhelming evidence, he was not convicted. Ashley was not convicted. However, in a second trial in 1915, he was sentenced to hang for Tiger's murder. But that conviction was overturned by the Florida Supreme Court. Now, during this time, Ashley escaped from various local jails and eluded law enforcement until he was gunned down at the Sebastian River Bridge at Roseland. Now, although he was incarcerated for other crimes, Ashley never served any time for the murder of DeSoto Tiger. Now, the story of his death and that of his gang goes like this. And they had so many exploits, it was incredible, but that would be a separate show. Now, it's November 1st, 1924. All right. And the sheriff, Bob Baker, he gets a tip that Ashley is planning to head up to Jacksonville and then come back and kill him. Remember, they have a long-standing feud going on at this time. Now, he alerts the St. Lucie counterpart, which was a sheriff by the name of J.R. Merritt, and lets him know that Ashley is going to be heading his way. Now, Sheriff Baker sends up four of his deputies who join Merritt and two of his men. At about 10:45 p.m., a red lantern is swinging from a chain strung across the wooden bridge at St. Sebastian River. Now, two young men from Sebastian pull up, and Sheriff Merritt steps from the bushes and tells them to drive on. Now, coming behind them, there's a Ford with John Ashley inside and his gang, which was Hanford Mobley, Ray Shorty Lynn, and John Middleton, which, by the way, a lot of his gang members were families also. And they come to a stop, and they get surrounded by the lawman. Now, the two young men who had come up to the bridge before, they turn around and their headlights fall on four men standing handcuffed on the bridge. Now they race off to Sebastian and tell everybody that John Ashley's been captured, because by this time John Ashley and his gang were notorious. They were very well known. But before they get there, the gang members are dead. Now the bodies are taken to Fort Pierce, and they're displayed on the grass in front of a mortuary. And in the morning, they are laid out on a sidewalk for gawkers. Now, doesn't this remind you of stories that you've heard of the Old West, where gunmen and gunslingers, they would be put in their coffins and displayed outside maybe the saloon or wherever in the middle of town? Things like this. Well, this is exactly what they did here. Now, the official story told by the deputies were that that when John Ashley had saw the glint of the lantern handcuffs, that his phobia caused him to drop his hand and shout, "Shoot, boys, they'll never put those things on me." And that's why they shot him. Now, a judge ruled that the shooting was justifiable, and the deputies took an oath and never to speak of it again. But, you know, there's always a but in there somewhere. In the 1950s, when all but one of the deputies who had been on the bridge had died, the last deputy confided to the actual story. He went ahead and he talked about what had actually happened that night. What happened was that the sheriff and all the deputies believed, they were convinced, as a matter of fact, that no jail could hang this, could hold the gang. Because remember, by this time, John Ashley had escaped and broken out of jail several times. Now, they had handcuffed John Ashley and made him raise his hands. And as they cuffed the others, Ashley began to drop his hands, and a deputy shot him dead. And the others fired wildly, and then the rest of the gang was killed. Now, the deputy said he scooped out Ashley's glass eye for Sheriff Baker. And I'm going to explain. In one of his shootouts, various shootouts that he had, John Ashley had gotten shot in his face, and he lost an eye, and he had gotten a glass eye instead. So this is what the deputy scooped up to give it to Sheriff Baker. Now, later on, he found out that the eye had been returned to Ashley's family, okay, and the deputy said he had one regret, is that he would have crushed it with his heel if he had known where it was going to end up at. As you could tell, there was no love lost between the law and the Ashley gang. Now, during this time that John Ashley is running around the Everglades and being an outlaw, of course, he has his own queen, and her name was Laura Upthegrove. Now, she acted primarily as the gang's lookout. Whenever she heard that authorities were nearing one of Ashley's hideouts, she would drive her car through secret backwoods trails, often without headlights, if at night, to warn the other gang members. She also cased banks for them, and she served as a getaway driver. And while they were together, she became known as Queen of the Everglades, and she took a central role in the gang, even while he was incarcerated. Now, like I said, 1924, you know, he gets killed, and she lives under an assumed name in Western Florida for a time. And during those 2 years, she gets arrested on several occasions, and then she comes back and eventually opens a gas station at Canal Point on Lake Okeechobee. Now, on August 6, 1927, this is what, not even 3 years after Ashley's been killed, she died during an argument with a man trying to buy moonshine from her. In the heat of the moment, she swallows a bottle of disinfectant and died within minutes. And it's unclear whether it was an accident, as some claim she mistook it for a bottle of gin, but it was widely reported that she had committed suicide. She was only 30 years old. Now, only $32,000 of the gang's fortune was ever recovered. And it was found only with the help of an ex-gang member by the name of Joe Tracy. A reported $110,000 and other Everglades stashes have never been further reported. I'm going to talk, even though I spoke about it, there's two known ghosts of Clustonen. Kind of known. Okay, the first one is a lady by the name of Anita Reese Conklin. Okay, she was 80 years old when she died in October of 1994. And she and her husband had lived a very long time at the Clouston Inn in room 255. This is where she and her husband would go to each night because he was the manager of the Miami Seaquarium. Incredible to think that this man drove back and forth between there and Miami. But anyway, now they were apparently they were a very nice couple who got along well with everybody. And it appeared that they did not have any family living nearby. They rarely had visitors. And he had died several months before she did. And I guess at that point, they got a hold of some surviving family members who told the inn just toss out all of their belongings. And what they did was they took a lot of their stuff and they just threw it out the top story window to a garbage bin on the ground below. Remember, they were on the second floor. Now, what was tossed out, and for example, they found a photo album that had a photograph of Mr. Conklin meeting with famous dignitaries and presidents. And it also had an itinerary for a presentation that he did at on the Merv Griffin show. And the couple, they enjoyed photographing. And what was really unusual, in the sense that it relates later on to part of the haunting that they consider that they're responsible for, they had a photo of the Clouston Inn switchboard in the album. Now, one of the things is many of the employees have reported strange things, which is the usual. This is the norm. These are the people that are there day after day. Now, one of the complaints from the employees that they felt the presence of something around them and actually felt something tugging at their clothing or hair, and they turn around to see that the space is empty around them. They also have reported getting calls on the switchboard. There's also some of the stuff originating from that room. So a lot, that's why the Conklins, or at least Mrs. Conklin, is thought to be the ghost in room 255, besides the fact that they lived there, or whether it was because they just chucked their stuff out. There's haunting tied to the feelings and also to the switchboard and phone calls coming in when there's nobody there or no connection, etc. But all in all, from what I found, the haunting tied into that room doesn't seem to be malicious or anything like that. However, a number of incidents have been reported, not surprisingly, throughout the end and inside the kitchen, but the most active area is inside room 118. Now, a lot is not known about this room except that there's the figure of a woman that sometimes appears here and moves very slowly across the room occasionally when the room's front door is open. Now, she walks almost sliding to to the back wall where the window is, and she makes like a brushing or sweeping motion against the walls, and then she disappears. There have been several reports, and even some ghost hunting teams, I don't know exactly who's been there, have reported, or I guess they either documented the same occurrence. And the workers here are very mindful. A lot of them are said to knock on the door of the room before they go in. And like I said before, I guess they don't, might be out of respect, but I think also just they don't want to see something they don't want to see. There's been a couple of people, though, who have reported that encounters with this unknown lady from room 118, she comes across as being quite malevolent and sinister. As to who she is, nobody knows. And as you'll see when I go into the rest of the story, so many things happen in and around Clouston Inn. She could be anybody. Okay. Now, around this time, right around when this hotel opened back in 1924, they start seeing some buzzards flying over Canal in Clouston. Now, this was by one of the workers out in the field. When they come to where they see the buzzards flying, They found three of them already feasting on the body of a well-dressed young man with three bullet holes in his breast. He was unidentified and no clues as to who the murderers were. Needless to say, it remained an unsolved mystery. This is the 1920s, and as you could tell, even from what I said before, there was a lot of interesting things going on during this time. Prohibition, bootlegging, lots of stuff going on. As to why he ended up being shot in the chest and dumped in a canal, eaten by buzzards. Then in March of 1943, okay, this was a very unusual incident. And it was a lady, she was a Clouston housewife by the name of Viola Stone. She's killed instantly when she's thrown from a truck she's traveling in to land under the wheels of another truck. The truck she was riding in swerved so hard to avoid hitting the truck that she flies out and gets run over. That was very unusual. Now, during this time also, believe it or not, the number 5 British Flying Training School was there in Clouston. They established it west of the city at Riddle Field, and over 1,800 British cadets were trained there as RAF pilots during the war. Now, after World War II, they brought in citrus groves, and of course they did more farming for winter vegetables. So in other words, it was, you know, it wasn't only the lake, and you know, this is also when the sugar, what happened was that they were doing more agricultural, and they were also bringing in more workers. Now, in August of 1947, a gentleman by the name of George Dunkley, who's age 41, this is, again, a very unusual death. He's originally from Cuba, but he's a British subject, and he was a field foreman at the U.S. Sugar Corp. Now, he died from internal injuries after mysteriously being run over by a tractor. The driver of the tractor had turned it off before leaving the field, and he says he heard it turn on. He comes back and he finds George Dunkley's body trampled in the wet muck. It was thought that he had turned the tractor on and somehow was thrown from it and ended up under its wheels. Again, there was really no explanation for how that happened. Now remember, this was a foreman. This was somebody that you would think would know how to handle one of these tractors, and how he ended up turning it on and being run over it, that was never explained. Now, in 1954, they had what was called the Glades Axe Murder. All right. And in November of 1954, Jack Lacey Johnson, age 53, this was the last time that somebody saw him alive. He had gone out to a hunting trip, and then nobody sees or hears from him again. Now in December, 5 Boy Scouts are walking along the shore of Lake Okeechobee in Clouston, and they find the decapitated body of a man. 4 feet away is his head, and then about 15 feet away is the axe. Presumably the murder weapon. Now, the victim turned out to be that body belonged to Jack Lacey Johnson, who had been missing since November. A guy by the name of Charles Lamar Douglas, age 18, from Clouston, was accused of the murder, and he was arrested in Fort Myers after being found driving the victim's car. Later on during the trial, he had even sold the guy's shotgun to some other man. He was convicted and received a sentence of life imprisonment. And supposedly, the motive was robbery. And it was just, if it wasn't for the fact that those Boy Scouts had found the body, it would never have gone unsolved as an assault. It would have just been somebody that disappeared. Nobody ever heard from again. And sheer luck that his body was discovered. Now, in January of 1956, a young lady by the name of Veronica Ball, age 24, she commits suicide by jumping to her death after donning a white chiffon gown and a negligee. Now, she was originally from Clewiston. She committed suicide when she was in Washington, D.C., but her parents were still back in Clewiston, and her husband, who had gone up to Washington with her, had gone back to Rayford, Florida for a job, and that had been over a year ago. So basically, she had been living up there for like a year. That was very unusual, and she was originally from Clewiston. The reason why I bring that up is that chances are that Veronica, if she ever did become a ghost, I'm sure she didn't haunt Washington. She went right back to Clewiston, where she grew up, where her parents were, and where her husband was. Okay, now in November of 1965, there's another lady by the name of Ruth Vaughn. She's 67. She lived and she died at the Clewiston Inn. She was like Miss, like Conklin, like Mrs. Conklin, only this was almost quite a few years before that. Same thing, she lived and died at the Clewiston Inn. This was unusual. In April of 1994, Daniel Davis shoots Ricky Grimsley, his estranged wife's boyfriend, as he runs away from him down the aisle of the local Clewiston Winn-Dixie. I remember seeing this Winn-Dixie, and I wonder if there's any type of residual, even intelligent haunting attached to that Winn-Dixie. You know, you just can't make that up. Now, in January of 1997, a 63-year-old sugar worker by the name of James Wooding, he's abducted, beheaded, and buried in a shallow grave out in the sugar cane fields. His burnt car is found nearby. Now, he had been working in that area as a sugar worker since 1970. And one of the men accused of killing him was a guy by the name of Armando Martinez, who also lived in Clewiston. And it's believed that the killers, because there was more than one of them, and the victim knew each other, and maybe it was over robbery, who knows, but, you know, talk about very grisly ways to kill somebody. And the last one that I came across was in November of 2013 in a canal just south of Clewiston. A single mom by the name of Kimberly Lindsay, her body was found. Well, at the point when it was found, it was unidentified, and she had been shot, decapitated, and her fingers cut off. Now, her ex-husband, Dr. Albert Lambert, who they thought was the murderer because they had had a very acrimonious divorce, he committed suicide by taking an overdose of barbiturates at his sister's house in Miami right before the police came to arrest him, and they left behind three daughters. Now, I'm gonna let you see the morning after, you know, when we woke up the next day at our room in the Clewiston Inn and see what happened. And I'm telling you, when you do this research, you never look at these places quite the same again. Because prior to my visit, really all I had known was that the Clewiston Inn had a reputation of being haunted, and, you know, about the two supposed rooms. And you know, when you do the research, you come to find out that there's so many things that could be going on, paranormally speaking, in and around that inn, just because of what's happened there. And like I said, this is what's documented. I'm sure there was a lot of other things that happened that were not documented that could account for a multitude of paranormal events. So I hope you like what happened the morning after. Check it out.
Hi, everybody. This is Marlene again. Okay, it's the morning after that I stayed here at the haunted Clewiston Inn here in Clewiston, Florida. And as a matter of fact, I'm here at the very end. Come here, Henry, so we can pan out. Over here on the side, this is the side of the hotel. I'm at the very end of the hallway. And till 2 a.m., nothing. Okay, so finally, you know, I went to sleep. And that I can remember, I didn't wake up for anything, but I do remember having like really weird dreams. And by this, I didn't have frightening dreams. And what I can remember is that I've always felt like, you know, like when you're walking around hallways, you know, some place you like, you're not really frightened, but walking around like exploring, which is really weird. That's not, and to be honest with you, I really haven't had a chance to look through the hotel, so I can't even say, oh, I picked it up from here, because last night when we checked in, it was around midnight, and what we did was we just checked in and came straight to our room. We didn't go exploring throughout the hotel, so I can't even say I picked up this walking through the hallway thing from something I was doing earlier, because I didn't. As a matter of fact, that's what we're going to do now. And however, besides those weird dreams of me walking around, it felt like long hallways, and I mean, a lot of people could read symbolism into that. Henry told me that he had, in the middle of the night, he heard me, what was it, Henry, muttering?
Yeah.
Muttering, like, and I never, and I'm saying I never talk in my sleep, mutter in my sleep, walk in my sleep, none of the above.
Yeah, I thought it was something wrong with you.
Okay, yeah, because I was, what, facing away from you,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And he was thought for a minute that I was still awake. It was like, what, 4:30 in the morning or mm-hmm. something like that? He thought, what, she's still awake.
I thought it was 6,
okay, and he realized that I was still asleep, but I was muttering. He couldn't, according to him, he couldn't make out what I was saying, which is really unusual, which might also coincide with the time that I was having my dream. It's difficult to say that I'm walking down these hallways. Now, I want to show you something that, believe it or not, unusual, but you see this? You see this? This is a remote control. Okay. Ever since we checked in last night, of course, we turned on the TV and enjoyed viewing something with internet because we, you know, we went to Hurricane Irma and we recently got electricity back and our internet's not up. So we were enjoying it. So, but anyway, button up, unbuttoned volume. It, at the beginning, the volume kept changing. And me and Henry kept thinking that each of us had either had slipped under us and we had pressed it, whatever. We weren't paying attention to this, except when it kept happening. And this morning, after we were awake, it kept happening, and we realized there's something going on. This, and I know this sounds like almost like, but it's true. We realized the volume on this TV. I mean, and some people say, well, it's electronic. You know, if it responds, if you lower the volume, it'll lower, or you. But by itself, the volume keeps changing, and then when you look at the bar that shows you the volume intensity, it's gone up. Like, in other words, it's not that it's here. We can't figure it out. So that is really unusual. That is the first time that I've had this happen to me. And by the way, this is an old hotel, but it's been renovated with a lot of modern amenities, okay? Like, it's got a flat screen TV, you know, it's really, really tastefully and upgraded, really modern. It's nice. It's not like, okay, you know, there's an old hotel with old electronics who are acting up. No, I'm telling you, there is something going on. Somebody was doing something with the volume.
And yeah. The funny thing about it is, and they keep spare batteries in this room, and we changed them last night.
Yeah, that's right.
They kept spare yeah. batteries in the drawer.
Yeah.
And we changed them brand new, and it still did it.
It's still doing it. We thought, okay, well, maybe there's a certain channel that for some reason. I mean, we changed channels, and it happens regardless of the channel. The volume switches out by itself. That at some point, you realize it. At the beginning, we realized it was like, why is the TV so loud, you know? And then we realized, wait a minute, so we would look at the bar and we're like, why is it so loud?
And we
would lower it.
And we even didn't even have the remote next to us.
Yeah,
and it was doing it.
Yeah, and it was like, but then, like I said, the first few times you don't pay attention to it because you're caught up in other things. But then we're realizing throughout the night or in this morning, we have the TV on, that somehow or other, the TV always ends up blaring despite the channel. And like I said, something's going on here. This is room 226, folks. And I don't know if anybody else has had experiences, you know, in this room. I don't know what to tell you. I know this might even have sometimes be used as a suite, because if you look, you can see this door.
It's a connecting room.
Because this is, we're at the very end of the hallway, okay? And this, you know, these doors, you make it into a commuting room. You know, door. In other words, you can make this into a suite if you ever had anybody living here, which, by the way, which is one of the hauntings attached to this hotel, was a couple that lived here, okay? And I'm sure that's what they would do. They would open up the adjoining door and basically they would make up an apartment. So come out here, let me show you, okay? You can tell this is the old, this is where you can see some of the age on it and the door. See, you could tell this is, they still, but it's very tasteful. And come here. Okay, and you could tell, like, here, see, this is the adjoining room. And we are, go out to the hallway, Henry. I just don't want
exit, we're at the end of the hallway.
And by the way,
see,
look up there, Henry. I want you to show up there. Look up there. And we've got an entrance to the attic. Come on in. Come on back, Henry. And there's, and I'm going to, and if anybody's seen me in other videos, you will know that's one of Marlene's theories that have found, not a theory. I basically, it's based on my experience of different investigations, that for some reason, the areas, whether it's the room, the kitchen, wherever there is a crawl space or the entrance to an attic, it never fails that that area is usually the scene of some disturbances, noises, I don't know what to call it. And I've gone through different houses, old houses, new houses, attics, full attics, crawl spaces. Everybody will say they hear things, stuff that goes on around it. And I know that part of it, like I said, based on my experience, is that for some reason you do have intelligent hauntings and discarnates, which basically hide themselves away in these areas. One of two things, either because they want to stay clear and they're hoping they don't want anybody to find them, or they kind of hang out there to the appointed time that they relive whatever it was that maybe was part of their routine or whatever it's basically making them earthbound. Okay, you know, like you hear some hauntings are only at certain times, and you ask yourself, well, where do they go when they're not here? Sometimes they do exactly that. And you might think, well, why would a spirit who has no body want to hide themselves? In some cases where you have an entity that is self-aware that they're dead, but they don't want to go on for whatever reason, they kind of know enough to hide themselves away. Especially in a place like this, let's say like the Clouston Inn, which has got a reputation for being haunted, it's got ghost hunters that have come here, you have psychics, and along the way you even have people that, and I don't know if they've ever attempted to basically send them on their way, cross them over, and they're very resistant to it. Whatever reason, fear, routine, it could be a million things, but they don't. When I looked at that, I said, oh wow, okay, that makes sense as to why I believe that there's something going on in this room. Right outside the doorway is that that entrance to the attic. The way this is set up, like with the door here, I believe that at some point when it was built in the 1920s, this might also have served as a suite where people lived. Besides, we get a lot of transient people in hotel that account for haunting. So, and I'm gonna do my research. So guys, I'm gonna be taking a walk now on the grounds and let's see what we find. And hopefully I can run across some staff that will tell me some interesting stories. Cross your fingers, let's see what happens.
I don't know if they have over here I guess this is like a little meeting room. Oh, cool. I guess it's like a little conference center.
Mm-hmm. I love the furniture.
Yeah, I know. It's very pretty. I like it. As a matter of fact, I like the rug, too.
Mm-hmm.
Very nice.
Wait, can I see that?
Yeah. Yes, uh-huh. Like from what, the 80s or 90s?
Yeah.
Wow. That's an old TV.
Pretty cool, huh?
Yep. Let me see.
All right, buddy. Heading up?
Yes, we are heading out.
Okay. Thank you so much. I told her about that. I was expecting you that you saw something, man.
That's
I saw that every day.
Okay, it'll do. At least it's nice weather.
Yeah.
Oh my God, that's cute.
That's a real bicycle.
No. That's a very nice whatchamacallit?
Planter.
Oh, I guess this is a 1976 Civic Park. You know what? This park was probably done for the bicentennial. Be careful. Hold on. Really nice weather, beautiful weather. You have a special appreciation for that after going through a hurricane. Believe me. Special and deep appreciation for that. Hold on, let me get my keys open. Oh yeah, their houses aren't habitable. All right, folks. This is the very beautiful Clouston Inn. I want to do a little bit of research and see what's up, because in my experience, despite all the well-known hauntings, there's usually more that goes on that has never come to light. Let's see what happens. So we're off on the trail of paranormal adventures. See you guys later.
Well, what better way to end a video about paranormal events than with a ghost story? And this one is called The Man in the Sugarcane Field. Now, this was submitted by somebody that shall remain unnamed. So I'm going to tell it from their perspective. And what it says is, I'm really not sure if I'm able to describe this story in detail, because for the life of me, up to this day, I still can't determine what it was that I saw. When I was a kid, I usually spent the whole summer vacation at my grandparents' house along with my cousins. We would stay there for 2 months while my grandmother would take care of us as we were city kids, and my grandfather would tell us amazing stories at night before we went to sleep. Now, during those times, since we were kids, we always did naughty things. Now, one of the things I was always guilty of doing was stealing sugarcane from either the sugarcane fields or from the slow-moving sugarcane trucks. Of course, the adults didn't really pay much attention to us, thinking we were just playful kids, and stealing one or two stalks of sugarcane wouldn't really hurt. Sometimes they even knew what we came to their fields for, so the nice farmers would take out their machetes and cut out a stalk for us. Now, one afternoon at around 2 p.m., my cousin, let's call her Mary, and I were on our usual trip to the sugarcane fields. We were happily chattering and no one was around, and we tried to steal one of the sugarcane stalks. All of a sudden, we hear someone shout, and when we looked in the direction of the voice, it was a farmer. It was someone we didn't know, and obviously, he didn't know us as well. He kept yelling, "Thieves! Thieves!" while he was holding up his machete. We were so scared that we just dropped what we were holding and ran deeper towards the sugarcane field, trying to hide from him. While we were running, I kept looking behind to see if he was still hot on our trail. Kathy, which was my other cousin, had decided that day not to come with us, and she usually had a cool head on her shoulders. Unfortunately, Mary, who was with me, had run off and left me behind. But because she was wearing jogging pants, she didn't get as far as I did it, because I was only wearing shorts. Now, here we are. We've run deep into the sugarcane field. And I tried to look back to check out if our pursuer was hot in our trail, and I saw he was nowhere to be found. I felt relieved. As a matter of fact, I actually smiled. And I was about to turn to my cousin Mary to tell her that the farmer was gone when I bumped into her. Without thinking, I just said, "He's gone, he's gone." But I noticed she was standing as still as a tree, her eyes staring off somewhere. Instinctively, I looked at the direction of where she was looking. Then I saw it. It was a man, facing away from us. He was wearing a light blue shirt and worn-out corduroy pants. He didn't have any shoes on his feet. Would that have been normal, right? But what scared us was that he was standing on his head. No, not the normal headstand where you put your hands on the ground and raise your feet. He was literally standing on his head, his arms on his sides. What's more peculiar is that when you do a headstand, your clothes should hike up because of gravity. His clothes were perfectly intact. It's as if someone took a picture of him, cut the picture, and inverted it. I didn't think about anything anymore. I grabbed my cousin's arm and we ran to the opposite direction. I didn't care if the farmer was out there to get us. A farmer was definitely someone I could deal with compared to a person standing on their head. When we got home, my cousin Mary and I were so tired that we just collapsed on the grass inside the gates, trying desperately to catch our breath. Wordlessly, we just looked at each other with a knowing expression that what we saw was something not normal. We have asked the townsfolk about it, since they would be the most likely to know about any peculiar happenings, but none of them could give us any stories or answers. They were even surprised when we told them ours. So what do you think that was? That mysterious man in the sugarcane field.